welcome to this episode of Military History Inside Out. Today I speak with Tom Clavin, who has co-authored a book on Valley Forge, the important event during the American Revolution. So thank you and enjoy. I'm speaking with Tom Clavin, co-author of Valley Forge. Thank you for speaking with me.
Well, thank you for having me on the show.
So first, tell me how you got into studying and writing a book on this subject, and go as far back as you'd like.
Well, I personally have always had a very strong interest in American history, and, you know, from the colonial era, Civil War, things like that. And Bob Drury and I had a previous book called The Heart of Everything That Is about the Indian, Sioux Indian leader Red Cloud and America in the especially the plains in the 1850s, 1860s, and, you know, thankfully that was a very successful book for us and got a lot of wonderful feedback from readers since that was published. And I wanted to, and we wanted to, deal with another subject of American history, and not necessarily, you know, we weren't necessarily looking to go into the 20th century. So we thought, well, instead of going forward, let's go backward, you know, we thought about a Civil War topic as a possibility, and you know, we thought, well, a lot of that's already been covered. And I happen to be doing some trolling, I guess you could call it, and I came across a couple of things involving Valley Forge, which I think, like many people, my image of Valley Forge is what the illustration you see in your eighth grade social studies textbooks. It's a couple of guys freezing in the snow, and George Washington on a horse watching a couple of guys freezing in the snow.
Right.
How interesting could that be? And but I started to do a little more research and discovered, and eventually, you know, as we worked on this book with more research, came to the conclusion that it really was, to us, a turning point in the Revolutionary War. And there was so much going on and so many people involved that are iconic figures that we decided that this was something we wanted to do, because we wanted to tell the true story of Valley Forge and the whole story of Valley Forge, which I will contend that most people don't know how full and rich and complicated the story this is.
Mm-hmm.
So fortunately, our editor agreed with us, and you know, we got the green light to go ahead and do it.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so let's talk about the book then.
Sure.
So what specific sort of date ranges do you look at? Do you just go, you know, from, say, December to June to the Battle of Monmouth, or how do you lay it out, the story?
Well, we have the story is in three parts, so, you know, excluding that we have a prologue and that we have a rather lengthy epilogue that follows the rest of the lives of several of our most significant characters. So the book is really in three parts, and the first part is the fall of 1777 campaign, you know, when the Army, Continental Army, walked into Valley, or staggered into Valley Forge on December 19, 1777, it was really in bad shape, and we wanted to lay the groundwork for why. You know, it had lost at the Battle of Brandywine, it had lost at the Battle of Germantown, there had been the Paoli Massacre, in which the British attacked with bayonets in the middle of the night and slaughtered General Anthony Wayne's brigade. And so it was really in a bad way, and we thought we wanted to go through the steps of that fall campaign, and plus, you know, there's a lot of battles, a lot of exciting stuff, and introduce our most significant characters, you know, and then part two of the book is the initial couple of months plus at Valley Forge, when things just get worse and worse and worse, and we explain why, and also there were skirmishes going on, what's going on with the British, what's going on over in Paris, where Benjamin Franklin's trying to work out an alliance with the French. And Act 3, you know, Act 2 pretty much ends when the George Washington himself and his army are at the lowest point. And then Act 3 is sort of like the revival. It's not just the revival of the army, but we believe it's the revival of the American Revolution. And it takes us through to the climactic end of the of Part 3, not the book, because we do a lengthy epilogue, but the climactic end of Part 3 is the Battle of Monmouth Courthouse, when the British and the American armies clashed in what turned out to be the longest battle of the American Revolution. And it very much is a climactic battle that, you know, from Valley Forge to Monmouth Courthouse,
So I have two main questions I wanted to ask. First, do you talk about, I guess, Washington also had some troops stationed in some other areas apart from just Valley Forge, I guess minor groups, so to speak.
Right.
Do you touch on that, those at all?
The only one that we really touched on, because yes, there were some troops in the South, but not much was going on in the South. They were just basically on patrol in case the British decided to, invade or make a significant move in the South. There were some troops up by Boston and New England, but again, there was very little activity going on there. At the time of that point of the American Revolution, everything was concentrated in the Mid-Atlantic states. Washington had been kicked out of New York, and he had headed down to Pennsylvania and Philadelphia to protect the capital, which the capital of the United States was Philadelphia at that time. So that was the epicenter of the American Revolution, with one exception, and that is that there was an army in upstate New York. It was the Northern District, it was called, that was commanded by General Horatio Gates. Mm-hmm. And that did play an important role in the American Revolution and in what subsequently some of the political maneuvers that were going on in Valley Forge, in that in October of 1777, Gates and mostly with his on-field general and fighting leader Benedict Arnold, defeated General John Burgoyne at the Battle of Saratoga. So we do deal with that for a couple of reasons. One, it was an important event in the American Revolution and one of the few clear-cut victories for the Americans. And two, that event of the successful conclusion to that battle catapulted Gates politically in the eyes of many members of the Continental Congress, even to the point that during the Valley Forge encampment, there was an almost successful effort to replace Washington with Gates.
So, okay. And my next question, and maybe this is a major part of your book, is how was Washington able to keep all these people there in such harsh conditions? Did they have nowhere else to go? Basically, would they be hung if they went back to their homes? Or, how do you keep these people there?
Well, it was an enormous challenge. Washington wrote to what was left of the Continental Congress, and he said any day he expected his army to dissolve or disperse. As the situation got horrific with literally men with no clothes, they might have a thin blanket to wrap around them, no shoes, no food. We have to remember that, or it's worth pointing out that of the 12,000 men of the Continental Army that were taken into the Valley Forge in December, by the time that encampment was over, 2,000 had died. I mean, that's by far the greatest loss of life on the American side during the entire Revolutionary War. And it was because, a few men did die in some of the minor battles that they had, but mostly it was disease, it was starvation, it was exposure to the elements. So, inevitably, you had officers resigning their commissions and saying, I can't take this anymore, I've got a family to take care of back in Vermont or New Jersey. And you had the enlisted men, a militia and enlisted men, that many of them weren't deserting. It wasn't like maybe they were disloyal or they had given up on the American cause, but they were literally starving, and they became desperate, and they said, I've got to get out of here and run into the woods, and maybe I'll find something to shoot or catch and eat. And some of those who deserted were caught and brought back and were hung, were executed. Washington had to sign off on every execution. He had to try and maintain discipline. So, to some extent, it was the maintaining of discipline and the fear of execution that kept some men there. But the major reason was George Washington himself. There was an enormous loyalty to Washington. He was the commander-in-chief. He was somebody who was out among his men. He was sharing their privations. Mm-hmm. It wasn't like he was, sitting warm in front of a fire someplace else. And while his army was trying to survive on its own, he was there with them every day, 24/7, the whole encampment. And he would walk among them. And he had this great physical presence. He was 6'3", 6'3", 6'4", at a time when the average American male was probably 5'5", or 5'6". So he towered over them physically as well as spiritually. They revered him. And a lot of the reason why these men stayed and didn't disperse, is that there was an enormous amount of personal loyalty to George Washington.
So how much did the presence of Lafayette and von Steuben. Is that, am I pronouncing that correctly?
Yes.
How much did their presence, and maybe the presence of other sort of, I don't want to call them aristocratic because they're Americans, but, you know, they're the wealthier Americans of the colonies, are there with them as well, along with Washington?
Yeah, well, you know, most of the officers came from the, I guess you would call either wealthier class, educated class, and some were, of course, both. Alexander Hamilton, for example, who was Washington's right-hand man and lieutenant colonel, he didn't come from a wealthy class. You know, he had been born a legitimate child in St. Croix, but he was definitely a very educated man. And so that was, you know, one way that what became, you know, Henry Knox, who was Washington, became the head of his artillery, was not a military man, was not trained to be a military man, but he was a very educated and person. And picked up, you know, the rudiments of artillery. Lafayette, very educated, but also not very experienced in the ways of the world. You know, he was only 19 when he secretly, you know, left France to go join the American Army and present himself to Washington and say, whatever you need, I'll do it. And by the time he was 20, he was a major general and commanding a brigade in the Continental Army. Hamilton, I mentioned, was 22 years old. John Lawrence of South Carolina, another very... one of Washington's surrogate sons, 22 years old. And then you get to von Steuben. Sometimes you'll see it pronounced von Steuben, but, you know, most people will know the name von Steuben. He was a different duck altogether. First of all, he was twice as old as Washington's closest age. He was in his mid to late 40s. And he did have military background. He had been a captain in the army of Frederick the Great in Prussia. And so he was one of the few of the major officers in Washington's army who had actual training and good military tactics, who had practiced them, who had seen combat, you know, over in Europe and faced the British and other nationalities in their armies. Mm-hmm. So, you know, their presence in the camp did make a difference. You know, Lafayette had a lot of personal loyalty to him and a lot of passion and energy. You know, he was always looking on the bright side of things. And von Steuben, when he was there training the troops, he would get down in the mud with these guys and, you know, show them the very basics of this is how an army, you know, is to maintain discipline and how to fight a force as powerful as the British. So, Lafayette and von Steuben are major characters in the book, and I think two of the favorite characters. I mean, Washington considered Lafayette his son. Mm-hmm. In fact, during the Battle of Brandywine, when Washington got word that Lafayette was off his horse because he had gotten shot and was wounded, you know, he grabbed a surgeon and said, "You get there and you treat him as if he were my son." That's exactly what he said to the surgeon. Mm-hmm. And that their relationship is an important part of the book because it was something where Lafayette, he really boosted Washington's spirits at the lowest moments because of his confidence, his youthful cockiness. And idealism and optimism was something Washington desperately needed when things were really bad.
Mm-hmm. It sounds like Washington felt a great level of responsibility for almost every individual under his command, that he had this, you know, you could say this father figure type, but, you know, it seems it extends to even the thousands, you know, there in camp with him.
Oh, yes, it did, and it extended to the entire country. I mean, it was during the Valley Forge encampment when Washington was first referred to as the father of his country, and that was actually by a German-language Pennsylvania newspaper. And what they were commenting on is that there was this, Washington was a father figure to many of the men in the Army, and they felt this filial loyalty to him. But it was also true in a lot of ways, as far as the entire country was concerned, because during the Valley Forge encampment, the Continental Congress virtually ceased to exist, and that was not true of most of the rest of the war. They had been in Philadelphia, and the British suddenly made a move towards Philadelphia. Thankfully, Alexander Hamilton was on a scouting mission, saw the British approaching, and got to Philadelphia in the nick of time to get the Continental Congress to pack up what they could and get out of town. ASAP, the British are coming. And they all went running. Off they took off. And some of the delegates basically went back to their home states, whether it was John Adams in Massachusetts or Governor Morris in New Jersey or others in that made it to York, Pennsylvania, where they said they were going to wait out the winter there. But they were not an effective legislative body anymore. There wasn't anything they could do. They couldn't raise money.
Mm.
The money that the Continental Army, the script that they were trying to use to buy supplies, was worthless. They were divided over everything. There was this conspiracy they were wrestling with to whether or not to fire George Washington and replace him. So basically, the American government became Valley Forge. That's where it was headquartered. That's where Washington was, and his immediate staff,
mm-hmm.
and the hundreds of memos and general orders and everything they generated was the only effective running government that existed at that particular time in the Revolution.
Yeah, that's pretty interesting to think about.
Yeah.
And
the British at any time had decided to sneak out of Philadelphia and attack Valley Forge and capture or eliminate the Continental Army, no more revolution. That was it. It was done.
Mm-hmm.
Because they would have, even more so than capturing Philadelphia, they would have captured what was left of the American government.
Mm-hmm. Now, in a sense, I think the winter, as much as it hurt the American military, this Continental Army, I think it might have helped also because during the winter, I think the British wouldn't have been, they didn't want a campaign during the winter. I mean, that's in that time in history, winters generally stopped campaigning.
Right. Yeah, but a combination of several things. One was that, yes, there was a protocol that was followed, for European protocol that was followed, that you didn't go to war in the winter. The conditions are too bad. I mean, mostly you depended on horses and mules to carry your artillery around and for officers, and you couldn't do that. The mud, and the sleet, and the snow just made it logistically too difficult. It was harder to supply an army in the field. So for a couple of very good reasons, the campaign ended when the frost set in. So that was one reason. Another reason was that the Howe brothers, the admiral and the general, who were the leaders of the British forces in America, they and their officers were nice and warm and comfortable in Philadelphia.
Mm-hmm.
And they weren't that inclined to leave.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, when Benjamin Franklin in Paris first got the news that Philadelphia had been taken by the British, his comment was, Howe may think he's taken Philadelphia, but he'll discover Philadelphia will take Howe. And they had the American mistresses, they had plenty of food, they had comfortable shelter. What are they going to give that up for?
Mm-hmm.
But also, there was a strategic reason that the Howe brothers were thinking about. They knew, they had their spies, and they had American deserters that they captured and interrogated. And they knew that the conditions in Valley Forge were terrible, and that dozens of men were dying every day from disease and starvation and exposure. So what made sense to them is, we don't have to do anything. We could just let them keep dying. And by the time May rolls around, they figured, if there was still an army left, and they might have dispersed or dissolved by then, but let's say there was an army left, it would have to be a very weak and insignificant fighting force. We will easily defeat them when we go back into the field. So there was some sense to them thinking, we don't have to risk ourselves and any lives in the snow and all the difficult logistics of waging a campaign in the snow and the Pennsylvania winter.
Mm-hmm.
Let's let them all die off, and it'll just make it all that much easier when the time comes in the spring to defeat them, what's left of them.
Mm-hmm. Now, looking ahead to the results of the Battle of Monmouth Courthouse, I get the feeling that the most important thing about Valley Forge, among a number of important things, is Washington's drilling, putting military discipline into his troops. Did he plan that? Did he expect, okay, now this is what I need to do, or did it just seem something to do since they were there?
Well, Washington, his plan, such as it was that once the conditions improved, the weather conditions improved, in, let's say, April, he was going to do it the best he could to drill his troops and get them ready for the spring-summer campaign.
Mm-hmm.
But up to that point, there had not been a very effective training done for the Continental Army. primarily because there weren't that many officers who knew much about that, with any kind of military background, who knew the proper way to train and discipline troops. So that was a problem. And the other reason is that you had over the, you know, since the Declaration of Independence and up until the winter of 1778, you had a lot of troops coming and going. You know, there was the ones that initially joined up, their enlistments were over, they had headed home. Other bats came in. You had militias who were poorly trained, showing up and pretending to be regular troops. So, you know, it would be hard to believe that Washington would have been able to put in the field in the spring of 1778 a fighting force that was all that much different, all that much better trained than they were when they went into the winter camp back in December. The miracle, in a way, that happened is that suddenly Baron von Steuben showed up. And he had gone to see Franklin and the other American representatives in Paris. He needed a job. You know, he was an out-of-work captain for the Prussian army with some scandal hanging over his head and no money. He was broke. And he needed a job. So he went to Franklin and said, you know, I'd love to fight for your cause and give me a commission as a general and a salary associated with that, and I'll head over there. And Franklin, once he talked to von Steuben and found out that, yes, in some ways he's a con man, but in other ways he actually did serve as a captain in the Prussian army. He does know about training troops and about maintaining discipline and teaching men how to fight. I think that would be a good idea to send him over to join up with Washington. The problem was is that Washington would not have much confidence with this portly man who can't speak English, who was only a captain in the Prussian army. So Franklin gave him a fake resume. By the time von Steuben was sailing for America, he had been a lieutenant general in the Prussian army and the right-hand man to Frederick the Great. And he fought in all these battles. You know, he had all these recommendations that were just made up. And so he shows up at Valley Forge in a horse-drawn wagon with this uniform on that's beautiful and a French cook who quit after 24 hours. And saying, okay, I'm here, and let's take a look at what we've got here, what I've got to work with. Plus, he was appalled when he found out what he was going to have to work with. These guys that were the sentry duty, they were standing on their hats because they had no shoes in the snow. But he was energized by the challenge, and he got to work, and he got to work showing them the basics. Here's how you stand at attention. Here's how you march in a column. Here's how you make a right turn. Here's how you stand and get ready to counterattack when an attack is coming your way. Here's how each man is supposed to stand in his position when the guy next to him just got taken off by a cannonball. And this started in February when he showed up, and week after week after week, the training, so that, you know, Washington had probably in his wildest dreams, once the spring campaign began in late May, had a fighting force that was equal, maybe not equal, but much closer to the quality of the British troops that they had never approached before.
So that brings me to a question about the sort of the makeup of the army as far as nationalities and that sort of thing. How did he manage this mix, of troops?
It wasn't easy, because not only did you have, in the context of the army, you had troops from, you know, Vermont and Connecticut and Massachusetts and New York, and you had those from the Mid-Atlantic states, and you had troops from the Carolinas and from Virginia. And so you had regional conflicts and frictions between different regiments and different brigades. And then within that, you had troops made up of different nationalities. Some were, of course, American-born, but there were a lot of the troops in the Continental Army had immigrated from elsewhere. They had immigrated to the United States maybe in the 1750s, the 1760s, the 1770s, like many other immigrants, looking for, you know, some farmland, looking for an opportunity, escaping religious discrimination, whatever it was. So you had men who were from Ireland, from Wales, from France, from Poland, from Italy. you know, you had the Southern officers, the ones from the Carolinas and Virginias. The scariest thing they could see on a day-to-day basis were black men holding weapons.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that was their that was a nightmare of landowners in Georgia and South Carolina, North Carolina, Virginia,
mm-hmm.
They lived in fear every day of a slave uprising. And here within their own army, there's brigades, there's regiments of black troops with rifles and, mm-hmm. and muskets. So, it was a constant mixed bag. And in fact, the Continental Army would be the last time that an American fighting force in the field would be integrated into the Korean War.
Mm-hmm.
So it was kind of remarkable that you had this definitely, the Continental Army represented the melting pot that America had become.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And as far as von Steuben, I was just curious also, if he enjoyed it, you know, did the German troops take to him? You know, did the ones who were from Europe, not, you know, who had come from Europe not too long ago, I wonder if they took to him.
Well, I think that they were kind of surprised to see him, especially with his phony resume. Oh, he was a lieutenant general of Frederick the Great. What the heck is he doing here?
Yeah.
You know, I mean, we're here because we have no place else to go, and we're hoping that we can survive this war, and maybe they'll grant us, you know, 20 acres of land to farm. So that was what some of the, you know, the troops from Europe were thinking. You know, von Steuben, he encountered some of the German troops, which were a relief for him because he could, some of the training he could do, he could speak to them in German. But the majority, von Steuben could speak Prussian, German, and French. He could speak no English. So that became an interesting challenge because, you know, Alexander Hamilton or his best friend John Lawrence, both of whom were lieutenant colonels on Washington's staff, would be employed to follow von Steuben around during his training missions and translate for him. And, you know, von Steuben would get frustrated and he would start cursing at the troops in German or Prussian. Except for only the few German soldiers, they didn't know what he was talking about.
Mm-hmm.
So then he would curse the soldiers to Hamilton or Lawrence in French, and then they would have translated the French curses into English. So by the time this was done, you know, the troops were howling with laughter.
Mm-hmm.
You know, this was such a Punch and Judy show to them. But they did respond to von Steuben. They really respected him, mm-hmm. and they began to realize as the weeks went on, now we know how to be of an army. Now we know how to be a soldier. We can't wait to get at those British and show them that we're not the, you know, the rubes and the country bumpkins that we were before.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So let me turn towards what you used for your research. What materials did you gather to do this research for the book?
Well, thankfully there have been some very good books done on the American Revolution by some very good writers. I mean, Thomas Fleming, for example, Joseph Ellis, of course, David McCullough.
Mm-hmm.
So there is some very good scholarship out there and good storytellers. You know, I think it's interesting that every so often when McCullough is addressed as a historian, he'll actually say, "I'm not. I don't have a degree in history. I'm a storyteller." But obviously, he's a tremendous researcher.
Mm-hmm.
There's Ron Chernow's massive biography of George Washington and his massive biography of Alexander Hamilton, which inspired the Broadway musical.
Mm-hmm.
But the greatest resource is that is the contemporary letters and memos and diaries and journals that were kept. As I mentioned, many of the officers in the Continental Army, from lieutenants right up to generals, came from an educated class of people. And so they were writers. They liked to record their thoughts. Marquis de Lafayette, for example, was a very busy letter writer. He's constantly writing letters to members of Congress, to his family members, to his wife back in France.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, there's two volumes of letters that Lafayette wrote while he was at Valley Forge that have been translated into English. And so those are very helpful. There's diaries that were kept by privates, by sergeants. There's one by a Connecticut surgeon, some years later, they named a fort after him. That was under siege by the British during the War of 1812, and that inspired the composition of the Star Spangled Banner. Hamilton he couldn't help himself but write. He was constantly writing. John Lawrence, there's a whole volume of his correspondence. George Washington himself, I mean, he wrote something like 2,000 letters, memos, notes, general orders during the Valley Forge period, and you know, to read every one of those is a daunting task, but it's a great wealth of information, not only because of the details and the day-to-day operating of his army, but his thoughts, his feelings. Washington was a man of great emotion that he usually tried to hide, but every so often it came out when he was, you know, writing a letter to somebody who was close to him, and this, you know, this kind of contemporaneous research material was so much of the book is based on. We wanted to have readers really feel like, you know, they were there at Valley Forge. You know, after finishing a chapter, we want somebody to go to the thermostat and turn up the heat a few degrees.
Did you visit Valley Forge?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, at Valley Forge itself, of course, has quite a few documents and materials. And yes, you want to see what the layout of the encampment was like. I mean, obviously, it's not remained as it was in 1778 when the army left, because when the army left, it was farm country, and the owners of the property came back in and tore down a lot of the huts that had been built in shelter of the men and, you know, converted it, a lot of the land back to farmland. But still, they recreated some of the huts and the boundaries of Valley Forge, and you can still go to the Potts House, which is the three-bedroom house that housed not only just Washington, but all of his staff, crafted inside this little house. You can see some of the breastworks that were created as defensive positions at Valley Forge. And one of the great, great things about Valley Forge, which I have found true of many national parks, is talking to the park rangers. They're, you know, wonderful, wonderful people, and they care very much about their jobs. I mean, this is not, for most of them that I've encountered anyway, this is not just a punch the clock, I'm going to work today and I can't wait to leave. They themselves have done a lot of reading and research, and you ask them a question and they want you to ask questions. They want to have a chance to talk about the Valley Forge experience, and we found them very, very helpful.
Did you come across any interesting artifacts associated with Valley Forge?
Well, they have artifacts there at Valley Forge. They have the original muskets that were there. They have, you know, there were even things like bayonets that were found in campfires years and years later, because whatever the little bit of food that men would try and roast, they'd stick on a bayonet. They had no otherwise any utensils. There would be, bullets, I guess you would call them, that they would, you know, put in their muskets. There was some clothing that they would show, some tattered clothing that was, you know, found, and you could, you know, put it into exhibits there. I should point out that for anybody thinking of visiting Valley Forge, they shouldn't have expectations of a big, you know, national park. It's not Gettysburg. You know, Gettysburg was a huge area where a three-day battle in the Civil War took place. Valley Forge was a rather small and circled camp that was always in a defensive position, that was up on a plateau, and that housed the army. And if you go to Gettysburg, there's still a lot of the cannon and everything there. That was all removed from Valley Forge, but it's still a wonderful place to visit, and the people who run it have done a great job with maintaining the spirit of the place.
What part of the research was most enjoyable?
Well, I think I have a particular fondness for John Lawrence, who was from South Carolina. He's the founding father you never heard of. He was, like I say, only 22 years old. Hamilton's best friend. They were both two of the three surrogate sons of George Washington, Lafayette being the third. Lawrence is very much an idealist, very passionate, and his father, Henry, was the president of the Continental Congress, such as what was left of it. And he was constantly writing to his father to keep him informed of what was happening at Valley Forge, and he was hugely loyal to George Washington. So he had a lot of insight into Washington as a human being, as a person, that you don't get from a lot of the history books. I mean, Lawrence was there with him every day. And Lawrence was also somebody, here again, he's from South Carolina, was really trying to recruit black troops, he kept asking Washington for permission to go to South Carolina and to Georgia and to North Carolina and raise these regiments of black troops. And Washington was even, you know, saying, okay, if you think you can do it, but the Southern officers were saying, no, you can't do that. Yeah. We don't want to, you know, open our tent flaps one day and see, find that there's 1,000 black men with muskets standing there. Mm-hmm. There'll be a rebellion within the army. Mm-hmm. So, but I think reading his letters, he's funny, he's passionate, he's constantly chafing. He wants to get out there for a battlefield command. He, you know, his ideal is to be on a horse with a sword high in the air, charging against British troops in a rousing battle action. And he's educated, but he's also kind of naive. He's loyal, but he's also sometimes fearful of what the outcome's going to be. I just found reading his letters were really fascinating. And the reason why, I might as well mention it now, that he's the founding father you'd ever heard of. I mean, he would have been like Hamilton, a member of Washington's cabinet. He would have been like Henry Knox, a member of the cabinet. Or he would have been a senator, representative of South Carolina, an important person in the American government. Mm-hmm. But he finally got his wish. In 1782, he was the head of an American force, and he found out about the British approaching, and he saddled up, and off they went, and they charged the British, and there he was, sword in the air, charging the British, and a bullet found him, shot him right off his horse and killed him. He was only 27 years old.
Wow. Oh, that's unfortunate.
Yeah.
What did you find that was most surprising?
I think how many layers there were to the Valley Forge encampment. How many, I don't mean physical layers, but I mean, there's the surface story of men surviving. There's the interaction of Washington and his immediate inner circle, the interaction with his generals. The camp followers, there were 400 women who were part of the Continental Army, not as fighters, but they were the escorts and girlfriends and ladies of the evening and mothers of their children and everything like that. Who knew that they where the army went, that hundreds of women went also, some of them with children. There's what's happening with the British in Philadelphia. There's what's happening in Paris with Franklin. There's even, one of my favorite parts of the book is that it was during the Valley Forge encampment that the United States deployed its first attack submarine. Mm-hmm. And I mentioned that to somebody, and they'll look at me like I have two heads, and I'll say it's true. You know, in January of 1778, Washington was approached by a man named David Bushnell, an engineer for Connecticut, mm-hmm. who said, I've invented a submarine, and I've invented a weapon called a torpedo. And my submarine will go underwater and attack a British ship with a torpedo and blow it up and then, you know, go underwater and escape. And Washington said, I'm not sure I know what you're talking about, but if you think you can do it, go for it. And it actually happened that Bushnell put his submarine in the water and traveled underwater to the British flagship in the Philadelphia Harbor. The torpedo was supposed to be attached in some way to the hull of the ship, which it couldn't be, so it was just left by the ship, and with limited amount of air available, the guy in the submarine had to paddle his way back across the harbor with the sun coming up, and the British saying, what the heck is that thing in the water? They could see it a few feet underwater. There it was. But that became the very first example to be followed by, you know, as we know, over 200 years more of it, but the first American attack submarine. It was the invention of submarine warfare.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Was there a question that you found or an issue that you found particularly difficult to research and come to a conclusion on, or maybe you still feel like you don't have a satisfactory answer?
Well, I think the effort to depose Washington, I think what bothers me about that is if it had been successful, what a catastrophe, especially in the hindsight of 240 years. What an absolute catastrophe that would have been if, because John Adams, there were others who were thinking, you know what, Washington has had his chance, and it's time to find somebody new. And you had somebody like Horatio Gates saying, yes, here I am, you know, I'm ready, you know, let's get rid of Washington and make me the commander-in-chief. Mm-hmm. And the British-born Gates, of all things, not even like the American-born Washington. Mm-hmm. And that would have been a disaster, you know. Washington had the not only the personal loyalty of his troops, but the stature of the American military leader. I mean, even the British had enormous respect for him. he had been deposed and basically said, you know, thanks for everything, George. Go back to Mount Vernon and sit out the rest of the war. Mm-hmm. I can't imagine that we would have had a successful outcome to the American Revolution.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Was there anything you discovered that emotionally moved you in some way, either positively or negatively?
Well, I think that I was moved by the relationship between Washington and Lafayette and Lawrence and Alexander Hamilton. That, you know, Washington, who had no children of his own, when he married Martha, he did adopt her two children from her previous marriage. Mm-hmm. So I think that here he was on a daily basis with these three men surrounding him, young men who worshipped him. And he, in turn, was so affected by their loyalty. So there was that. I think also when Martha showed up was a very poignant time, because here she was, comfortable in Mount Vernon. You know, the wives did not necessarily have anything to do with the fighting that was going on.
Mm-hmm.
And yet she left Mount Vernon in the middle of February and made the travel through the snow in horrible conditions to be with her husband at Valley Forge. And I think that was to me, an emotional part of the book, that because they were devoted to each other, George and Martha Washington.
Mm-hmm.
And for her to give up the comforts and to share with him the deprivations, the freezing cold, the lack of food and everything, it was really a heroic act on her part and should not be overlooked. And certainly we don't overlook it in our book.
Mm-hmm. And actually, thinking about the women who were there in the camp, were there any births or conceptions that you came across at Valley Forge?
I don't know specifically about any that took place during the Valley Forge encampment, but we can assume there were. Because, like I say, the number of these women were the mistresses, the girlfriends, the companions, some officially wives of some of the troops, not so much the officers, but the officers' wives did not travel with the army, but the wives of the privates and the enlisted men, the non-commissioned officers, went along with the army because they did not, these men were not making enough money that they could afford to send money back to home and maintain a wife or a family. They depended on being with the army. Mm-hmm. and eating with them, whatever the little bit they had to eat, the little bit of wood they had for fires, the little bit of shelter that they were able to create or maintain.
Mm-hmm.
So, we can certainly assume that there were, shall we say, marital relations taking place.
Mm-hmm.
That had taken place before Valley Forge and during Valley Forge, and some of those resulted in births during the Valley Forge encampment.
Mm-hmm. Did so these the camp followers, did they get rations as well, or were they basically the soldier who was with them had to spread?
Yeah, it was what the soldiers were getting and what they could spare. So I think one of the really bad situations is that you had not only the soldiers themselves near starvation, or actually starving, but in many cases their companions, their children,
mm-hmm.
were you know, in a very bad way. I mean, we could even think that or presume that some of the soldiers starved because the little bit of food they got hold of, they were passing along to their wives and children. So it's really astonishing that the army survived at all. That when you consider that basically one out of every six men in the Continental Army died because of starvation or exposure or disease. If that had been a battle that took place in the American Revolution, that army might have ceased to exist or it surrendered because of such an enormous casualty rate. But this was during the Valley Forge encampment, and they somehow, enough of them managed to stick together to survive. And in doing so, that was basically the rescue of the American Revolution.
Mm-hmm. I think in the book you mentioned, or in some notes that accompany it, that this was literally the fourth largest, sort of, it's not a city, but if it were compared to cities in the colonies, it was like the fourth largest of some type.
Yeah, of the city in America, because, you know, you had Valley Forge itself was sparsely populated. It was farmland.
Mm-hmm.
There was not necessarily a town of Valley Forge, so
mm-hmm.
It was a valley. And so on is you had these residences with 12,000 plus people living in it. And so, you know, after Boston, after Philadelphia, after New York, after maybe Charleston, I'm trying to think of one other city that would be maybe Albany. And then after that, your next largest city in the entire country was suddenly Valley Forge. It was like a pop-up store. Mm-hmm. It was like a pop-up city, and put together within a couple of weeks. And so it was not only one of the largest cities suddenly in America, but like I said before, it became the seat of the American government virtually, because that's where Washington was holding together what was left of the political system in this country.
Mm-hmm. Do you know how much, and obviously Washington had military experience with large numbers of men, but did he have much experience in managing sort of an established camp for this extended period of time? You know, there's so much to manage.
Well, you know, he did have quite a good amount of experience in the French Indian War, where he was a colonel in the Virginia militia and raised his own militia force and even designed their uniforms and went into battle with them and trained them. And so he had all this. But you're talking about he probably commanded maybe 1,800, mm-hmm. you know, troops at most, probably less. And the campaigns, you know, were not lasting that long. He knew had Washington was, you know, at any different time in the war, was commanding anywhere from 6,000 or 7,000 to 15,000 to 20,000 troops. And on a campaign that basically went from 1775 to 1781 to Yorktown, basically. So, you know, he had experience. He was, you know, there really wasn't another American military figure who had this as much experience as Washington did. You know, Gates would claim that, well, I saw action with the British when in Europe, and another General Charles Lee would say the same thing, but we talked about an American general. George Washington was it. And he had no previous experience with a military force of this size, and for commanding it and maintaining it and organizing it and leading it for this long. You know, when he took over, I believe it was later in 1775 when Boston was under siege, and he didn't say farewell to his officers and his troops until 1783. So you're talking about 8 years. Mm-hmm. I mean, the pressure he was under, it was relentless for all those years.
Yeah. And, you know, his civilian experience was as a plantation owner. He had never been a mayor or any,
right.
you know, any occupation that involved managing this number of people.
Yeah, I mean, he spent some time in the Virginia House of Burgesses, but that was nothing compared to what he was being called upon to do, to be the virtual political leader and head of state of this young country.
Yeah.
So, you know, he some of it was learning on the job, some of it was you know, just finding out how to do things as he went along.
Mm-hmm.
And thankfully, he was a very intelligent man, and he was somebody with a lot of personal charisma. People were drawn to him.
Mm-hmm.
And he was a good judge of character, so for the most part, he was able to have a rep surrounding himself and delegating tasks to people who were very loyal and very smart, like somebody like a Hamilton, mm-hmm. and like somebody like a Marquis de Lafayette, Nathaniel Greene, and Anthony Wayne, and some of his other senior generals.
Mm-hmm. So what do you hope the book will do?
I hope, I think for two things. One, I hope, I do think it's the definitive book on Valley Forge. If I say that, I mean, people who read it will discover, wow, we never knew, you know, the truth about the story. Almost everybody from going to school in the United States will recognize the name Valley Forge, but a lot of people have absolutely no idea the complexity and the drama that was attached to it. So I hope that is one thing the book does. The other thing is that people will become reacquainted with George Washington. We don't see him a lot in popular culture. We don't see him portrayed in movies, you know, very rare. Same thing with TV miniseries. I mean, there was the show Turn that he was portrayed in. But he was our first president. He was the man who militarily won the American Revolution. And in our book, we show him as a very human person. He's not this stoic stock figure that's staring out at us from a portrait on a museum wall, or staring out of us for a textbook.
Mm-hmm.
He's he was a really good fighter. When they called for it, but totally courageous under fire. So I'm hoping that people will get reacquainted and maybe learn anew or discover anew what an absolutely remarkable figure he was.
Mm-hmm. Can you speak to any difficulties you had in finishing the book or getting it published and how you overcame those?
No, I can't, thank goodness. You know, the book took 3.5 years to do, and Bob Drury and I totally believed it in every step of the way. In fact, as we got deeper and deeper into it, we were, you know, gobsmacked at the all the details and then the threads to it and the characters who, you know, interacted with each other, some of which I haven't even mentioned that play important roles in the book. So we got just more infatuated with the story and with the characters. And really, from the very get-go, you know, we had published our two previous books with Simon & Schuster and with, you know, with our editor, Jofi Ferrari Adler, who, you know, we'd known for years, and he was very loyal to us, and we're very loyal to him. And so we had that champion within our publishing company, and when we turned in the manuscript, he loved it, and he, you know, his higher-ups loved it. So I really can't give you a story of, you know, we had to fight against the odds. We had people on board, you know, all along who really saw this as a wonderful book, and they couldn't wait to get it out there.
Okay, awesome. What's your next writing project?
Well, Bob and I don't have anything specifically right now. We're looking at a couple of different things. I do, in between during Klavan books, I do solo books that are completely different topics, ones that interest me, but that wouldn't be a Drury Klavan project. And I have one coming out in February called Wild Bill, which is the true story of Wild Bill Hickok, the first, you know, the American frontier's first gunfighter.
Mm-hmm.
So that'll be out in February, and obviously quite different from Valley Forge, but I had a book called Dodge City that came out a couple of years ago that was successful, and the publisher wanted to follow up with another book that takes place in the American West, and so mm-hmm. as a result, in February, readers will be able to pick up Wild Bill.
Cool. Where can people find the book, and where can they find your thoughts and maybe other writings online, like social media or something?
Well, I do have a website, tomclavan.com, TOMCLAVIN.com. I'm trying to, in the middle of updating it, but people can still have access to it. Mm-hmm. And as far as the book is concerned, there are the usual suspects. For example, there's the bookstore chains like Barnes & Noble, and there's Amazon, and BarnesandNoble.com, and there's other outlets. But we try and be big supporters of independent bookstores. I was just out in Denver at the Mountains and Plains Independent Booksellers Association convention, and I love doing events like this and meeting the booksellers. You know, they're the people that give you a career. You know, you can write all the books you want, but if you don't have people who are passionate about books that operate these shops that are, you know, that's the kind of place where you walk into and you say, you know, wow, I'm really looking for a good book on American history. Well, then the person behind the counter, in most cases, mm-hmm. will be able to say, well, here, let me show you this book over here and this book over here. So I'm so grateful that the independent bookstores exist, and I think that many of them are still continuing to thrive, mm-hmm. even in the Internet age. And so, you know, we really encourage people to look for Valley Forge in their independent bookstore. And if that's not, it's not available, that's not possible for any reason, well, then, of course, you do have Amazon and Barnes & Noble and some of the other, perhaps, you know, higher visibility outlets.
Mm-hmm. Okay. All right, that's all the questions I have. Do you have any final thoughts or words?
The only thing I can think of is that I think that, you know, I'm hoping that people will read Valley Forge and get an understanding of what the enormous courage was of the Continental Army, from the George Washington to his senior officers, right down to the privates. You know, we used the diary of Joseph Plum Martin, who was only 17 years old, and kept a diary during Valley Forge. And at any time, you know, you wonder what stopped them other than courage and loyalty and belief in the American cause of liberty. That's what stopped them from say, I give up. And they didn't give up. And because these men, the famous to those you've never heard of, did not give up, and I really think why we won our independence.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. All right. Well, thank you for speaking with me.
Thank you very much. I appreciate it.
This podcast has been presented by War Scholar. Thank you for listening. Don't forget to visit warscholar.org or militaryhistorypodcast.com for more great interviews and military history information. Your visits help support this podcast. One of the best ways to provide feedback for this podcast is to rate me on iTunes. Please give me a good rating if you liked it, or feel free to give me a bad rating if you didn't. I'll use that feedback to make this a better podcast. You can also follow me on Instagram under Chris Alvarez War Scholar. That's Chris without an H, C-R-I-S. On Facebook under War Scholar, on YouTube under War Scholar 1945, and on Twitter under War Scholar. Thank you, and I hope you return to this podcast for more great military history.